Let's go on then to a chapter that has to do with signaling. We're going to have two signaling chapters, one about electrical signaling and one about chemical signaling. This is the first one of the two. It's electrical signaling, so this is what happens in neurons. And we're looking at a neuron in this opening slide. A neuron is a nerve cell. Nerve is actually a collection of many cells, but a single cell within that nerve is called a neuron. And neurons are pretty irregularly shaped compared to most cells, which are more or less spherical. Neurons can be very, very long for a single cell. An individual neuron can, you know, be a meter or more in length, depending on the individual. But the basic shape, the basic anatomy of a neuron is that there will be a large bulbous part of it called the soma or the neurosoma or the cell body. Any of those names really mean the same thing. That's where you find the nucleus and therefore the instructions for how to make all the proteins that the neuron uses. Attached to that cell body are some number of dendrites, which you really shouldn't think of as branches, because in terms of the flow of information, that dendrites bring information into the cell body. So they are receivers of signals. And they send via electrical, via voltages, they send signals to the cell body itself. And then extending from the cell body, and not all neurons are shaped like this, but these are the ones we're going to talk about. Extending from the cell body is a long axon. And axons are, in a sense, an axon is the opposite of a dendrite. It's an outgoing, in terms of flow of information, it's a sender of information via electrical signals. And an axon might or might not be insulated by what are called myelin sheaths. If it's a myelinated axon, which means it has the myelin sheaths, those myelin sheaths are not actually part of the axon. They are formed by other cells that wrap around the neuron itself, but they might not be there at all, in which case it would be an unmyelinated axon. Anyway, at the far end of the axon are what are called axon terminals, or synaptic boutons. Axon terminals, terminal branches are just branches of one axon, but each one has an axon terminal on it. An axon terminal is the end of the line for that cell, and from those axon terminals, however many there are, the cell is able to release chemical signals. So the neuron itself operates within its own cell on electrical, or I should say more specifically, electrochemical signals called action potentials. But the result of action potentials is that at the end of the cell, at the axon terminals, chemical signals are released from the cell. And what do we call those chemical signals? Neurotransmitters, right. Neurotransmitters are chemical signals that cause downstream cells, in other words, whatever the axon is, whatever the neuron is connected to either do something or not do something, depending on the situation. Neurotransmitters are signal molecules, though. All right. Let's talk about membrane potentials. Slide 2. Neurons and myocytes, or muscle cells, are both examples of what we call excitable cells. An excitable cell is a cell that's able to create and transmit action potentials, which are these electrochemical signals we'll talk more about. That's what makes a cell excitable. So of your four tissue types that you're made of, epithelial tissue, connective tissue, nervous tissue, muscle tissue, two of those are excitable tissues, muscle and nervous tissue. The others are not. But even in non-excitable tissue, cells have what is called a membrane potential, which is a voltage. So there, what is a voltage? Well, a voltage really is just a name for a gradient of electrical potential energy. And a gradient, remember, is a difference from one place to another in something. Pressure gradient means there's higher pressure somewhere than somewhere else. Concentration gradient, higher concentration somewhere than somewhere else. Well, a gradient with respect to electrostatic charge means that there's more of a one type of charge here than somewhere else. And that's what we call a voltage. So one, you know, if it's from A to B, A has a different charge compared to B. There's a charge, unequal charge distribution whenever there's a voltage. In the case of a membrane potential, and potential here means voltage. When we talk about a membrane potential, it's really shorthand for a gradient of electrical potential energy. But we just call it potential as a noun. That really just means voltage. Okay. When we talk about a membrane potential, though, the membrane thickness is the boundary between A and B. So the two places that differ in their electrical charge distribution are the outer surface of the membrane and the inner surface of the membrane. Not the entire extracellular fluid and the entire intracellular fluid, just the little sheet of fluid right on the outer surface and inner surface of the membrane. That's where you measure the voltage. If you were to put two electrodes in there, you'd have to put one just outside and one just inside the membrane to measure that voltage, and you can do that. It's caused, this voltage that's in any of your living cells, it's caused by the fact that ions are not equally distributed. And ions, by definition, carry charge, right? They are charged particles. So when we talk about the voltage in the AC receptacle in the wall, one of those two electrodes is different with respect to the other one in terms of electrical potential energy. But the charge there is electrons. Here we're talking about charge being carried by much bigger things, not electrons, which are tiny, but ions, which from our point of view are still tiny, but they're huge compared to electrons. All right? So if a cell has a way to move ions around and keep them where they are, then it has a way to produce voltages across the thickness of the membrane. And that's what happens in your cells. It does this by pumping ions at the expense of energy, right? And you as animals have what as your main pump type? Sodium-potassium pumps operating through for one lifetime. They're operating until you're dead. Busy continuously pumping sodium and potassium. Well, that's the reason why in animals the sodium ion concentration is higher on the outside of the membrane where the sodiums are being pumped than on the inside, and just the opposite situation for the potassium ions. Now, the numbers here differ for different kinds of animals, but the direction doesn't change. The extracellular fluid has a higher sodium ion concentration than the intracellular fluid, and it's just the opposite case for potassium ions. All right? Well, when you move these ions around, slide 3 now, like I say, you are causing an unequal distribution of electrical charge, and therefore you're causing a voltage. But the pumps themselves are not the only players in the game. There are also all kinds of ion channels that will allow a certain kind of ion, but not other ions, through it. And ion channels can be either gated or non-gated. If they're non-gated, that means as long as they are in that membrane, That channel is going to allow that particular type of ion through it. And what's going to determine whether that ion goes through that channel or not? The gradient, but it's not just the concentration gradient. Since these are charged particles, the gradient that matters is what's called the electrochemical gradient. The chemical part of electrochemical refers to the concentration. That's part of it. But charge also matters. And so that's the electrical part of electrochemical gradient. Because even though a concentration gradient might tend to drive an ion one way, if that ion is negative, let's say, and where it's going to diffuse toward is also negative, that's going to repel it, right? So the overall effect is combined, the electrical aspect and the gradient aspect, or concentration aspect, into the electrochemical gradient. But with the operation of the pumps continuously, even though certain things are leaking through, eventually it will come to an equilibrium membrane potential, as long as the pumps are continuing to operate. If the pump shut down, it will come to a different equilibrium, and the cell will be dead at that point. But the equilibrium that's maintained by the operation of the pumps is such that the outer surface of the plasma membrane is comparatively positive. It has a higher number of positive ions associated with it, and the inner comparatively negative. Part of the negativity, by the way, of this inner surface comes from the fact that there are macromolecules, which is what M generally stands for here, that are negatively charged. Most of those are proteins. Proteins tend to have negative charges facing outward, so they operate like huge anions, really, even though they're not technically anions. They act like it, though, because they carry negative charge, but they're way too big to go through the membrane. They still, though, contribute to the negativity of that inner shell of fluid. Well, all cells have these membrane potentials. The important thing about excitable cells is that that membrane potential, which is more or less constant while these pumps are working, can be drastically changed. The value of it can be drastically changed. So a resting membrane potential in any given cell has a certain value, depends on the individual, but that certain value is some negative number of millivolts. Negative meaning negative inside. And so the non-excitable cells live their life at that value, whatever it is. Doesn't fluctuate much. An excitable cell can go from a resting membrane potential to an action potential, which is a drastic change in the value of its voltage. Now, it will come back to resting membrane potential after the action potential is over, but that drastic change in membrane potential, the action potential itself, is the electrical signal that we're talking about in this chapter. And this is the basis for how your neurons work and for how your muscle cells work. All right? In slide 4, we're just looking at the actual structure of the proteins involved in making ion channels. Ion channels are membrane-bound proteins or complexes of proteins. They can be a single polypeptide, they can be a multimeric protein, but hopefully it's obvious that they have to be transmembrane proteins, right? They have to stick all the way through the thickness of the plasma membrane in order for an ion to get all the way through the membrane. So these channels are made by multi-pass polypeptides that weave back and forth through the thickness of the membrane to form the walls of basically a tunnel. But it's a tunnel that's specific for a specific kind of ion because of the interaction between the ion and the fluid that's in the interior of that tunnel. That's why even though it might be big enough for a certain ion to get through that, only the right kind of ion will get through there. And like I said, ion channels can be either gated or non-gated. But since they are channels, they are at least sometimes open. Even in the case of a gated channel, it's sometimes open. And a channel can only be used for diffusion of ions, right? could never move something against its gradient using a channel. Because when you open up a tunnel, they're going to diffuse down their electrochemical gradient, not backwards. All right, so the pumps that we're talking about, the sodium-potassium exchange pumps, those are not channels. Those are a different kind of transport protein, right? Those are carrier proteins that latch on to whatever they're pumping, move them to the other side, and then let go. That's forcing them against their electrochemical gradient. If you open up a channel, though, and there's a gradient in place, that particle is going to go down its gradient through the channel, whether it's into the cell or out of the cell. Okay, you see the operation of a gated channel on the bottom. Channel gating is very important for action potentials, as we'll see. In 5, we're looking at a gated channel and showing you that this is specifically a sodium ion channel that's going to be a major player in action potentials that we'll look at coming up. This is actually a doubly gated, in a sense. This channel features two ways of being gated. It has what's called an activation gate and an inactivation gate. The activation gate is this part of the protein where the actual ion, sodium ion, goes through. And so it either opens or closes, changes shape to actually physically open the tunnel or not. The inactivation gate is another part of this overall protein complex that actually can plug this up if the conditions are right. Now, for sodium ions to actually flow through this type of sodium ion channel, both gates, of course, have to be open. If either one of them is closed, no sodium gets through. So just keep that in mind. But this is a doubly gated ion channel. Most are not doubly gated. Most are single gated, and like I say, some are not gated at all. The non-gated ones are called leak channels. Speaking of gated channels, gated ion channels, there are two major categories of those. And I'm not talking about with respect to how many gates they have here. I'm talking of the difference here is in how they operate. In other words, in what sort of thing it is that actually opens or closes the gates. So there are what are called voltage-gated ion channels. There's actually more than two categories, but there's only two that I'm going to talk about, I should say. There's voltage-gated ion channels, and as the name implies, the key that unlocks the gate is a special voltage. If that voltage, the value of that voltage is not present, then the channel will not open. It remains closed. This is an example of a voltage-gated ion channel. These are ones that are involved in the action potential. The other one that I'm going to talk about, though, in this chapter are called ligand-gated ion channels. And what is a ligand? Something that binds to something else, right. So in a ligand-gated ion channel, some particle has to come by and bind to the protein itself that's acting as the channel. And the same old story applies here. When a ligand binds to a protein, that causes a conformational change in the protein. In the case of a ligand-gated ion channel, that shape change is such that the new conformation will be so that the channel itself is open. So importantly, the ligand, the particle that's acting as the ligand, that's not the particle that goes through the tunnel. The ligand is just the key that opens the gate. Once the gate's open, the specific ion that channel is specific for goes through, assuming that there's a gradient in place. All right? Well, we're going to talk about both of these kind of gated ion channels, but the ligand-gated ion channels operate not in the action potential, but in a sequence of events that leads up to an action potential. Then in the action potential itself, voltage-gated ion channels take over. All right, now we can get to six and talk about the action potential itself. The graph that you're looking at is a graph of a single action potential. But there's actually more than just the action potential shown here. The leftmost part, just the horizontal part of this red trace, which is voltage, by the way. This is a graph of membrane potential, which is millivolts, versus time. So the higher on the graph, the more positive or less negative the interior of this, of the membrane is. All of this is measured with respect to the interior of the membrane. That's why we say at rest, the membrane potential is negative some number of millivolts. Depends on the cell type, the species, and whatnot. But in this case, about negative 60 millivolts for resting membrane potential. So this first horizontal part of the red trace is not the action potential at all. That is resting membrane potential. The cell is just maintaining that voltage because of the continuous operation of the membrane, of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. All right? Not only because of pumping of those ions, but because of subsequent leakage of some of those ions through the channels. But the equilibrium is such that it ends up being about negative 60 millivolts interior, with respect to the interior. Now, we're assuming this is an excitable cell, a neuron specifically, and so there can be some event that will change that membrane potential from the resting value to some other value. At the moment, while it's still at resting membrane potential, we say that this cell is it's polarized. Polarized with respect to charge across its membrane. It's polarized because it's not at zero millivolts, which would be equal positive and negatives both inside and outside. Right? Polarized means that one side is different from the other. So the inside is more negative than the outside. That's why it's polarized. There's two ways that you can change the voltage from resting, right? You can make it go up on the graph, which would mean less negative, or it could go down, which would make it more negative. An upward swing would be called a depolarization event because you're making it go towards zero. Zero would be not polarized at all. So if you're making the interior less negative, you're depolarizing it. An event not shown here but that happens that would be a downswing in the graph, making it more negative, would be called a hyperpolarizing event. You're making it even more polarized. The reason that's important is because for an action potential to occur, the cell involves voltage-gated ion channels. And remember, voltage-gated ion channels are controlled by voltages, certain values of voltage. The particular voltage that is actually the trigger value in this neuron is the value we see in dashed lines here, which for some reason is misprinted as positive 40. That should be a negative 40. All right? So that dashed line, notice, is labeled as the threshold potential. Potential means voltage. So the threshold potential or the threshold voltage is that particular voltage value at which the channels of the voltage-gated sodium ion channels in the membrane of this neuron open up. Up to now, they're closed. Okay? But they're not going to open up unless the membrane potential changes from its value at rest and changes by going upward in a depolarizing event up to the threshold. Well, what is it that causes this? Well, let me start that over. The part where the dark blue swath starts, when it no longer is just horizontal at rest, but starts to increase, starts to get less negative. It's still negative, but it's less negative as it swings up. This whole part in the dark blue width is called a depolarizing event. That's also not part of the action potential. But as soon as the voltage reaches the threshold, the action potential starts. So there has to be something that causes the upswing to get to the threshold potential. And that is caused by a flow of ions through channels that aren't involved in the action potential. So something happens that causes usually ligand-gated ion channels to open up. And once they open up, a flow of ions through those channels is going to change the membrane potential so that it gets closer to threshold. Once it hits threshold, then the action potential starts, and that's where I'll start describing things next time.